Corridor with Food for Faith in conversation with the Pope's astronomer, Jesuit Brother Guy Consolmagno, on his visit to Christchurch, New Zealand. The second of three gatherings is with the high school and university students of the region.
Hello, good to see you. Brother Guy, it's good to see you again too. We had lunch together today. There are about 200 people from the business community of
Move into you in the light so I can see more. Okay, thanks.
I was trying to put my head in outer space. So we had about 200 people from the business community in Christchurch for lunch together. It was a great gathering.
They were very tasty.
They were deep fried,
yes.
All of them. Brother Guy spoke to them for a while, and then we had this kind of conversation, which gave him the opportunity to say more of what he's found useful for other similar groups. But there were many things I noticed. There were parts of your talk, I have to be honest here, that I didn't understand right at the beginning. And then it moved to a level I thought, gosh, I wish I'd heard this when I was a student at school or at university, because for you, science is alive.
It has to be alive. Why else would you do it? The reason, actually, that I put this talk together is because too many of my scientific colleagues have forgotten the dream. They forgot why they wanted to be scientists when they were 10 years old. And it's become just a job. Or even worse, science becomes a contact sport where they think the idea is to knock the other person down.
Right.
And that's a miserable way to live. And it's not a particularly good way of learning the truth, which was the point of doing the science.
Well, the way that you spoke about it, I was thinking about it in terms of life choices, like many of you I know are probably thinking, what am I going to do for the rest of my life? And if it's about winning a game and making enough money or getting to the top of the ladder, well, what's the point?
I mean, as I said, my famous friend, you could be famous by going to jail as a spy. You could be rich, but then what are you going to do with the money? Because I've learned, when I was a student, I was big into stereos, and no matter how much money I spent in my stereo, I wanted the next bigger model. Maybe some of you are into computers, and no matter how fast your computer is, you really want the next bigger model. And it's never satisfied. That way lies madness.
So I want to invite you to be really specific here in terms of giving encouragement or advice to young people making decisions, like from your point of view as a scientist, as an astronomer, as a liver of life.
Where are you happy? And I mean really happy. Where are you more than happy? Where are you content? And the answer is going to be different for everybody. This is not an exam where you can copy off the person next to you. Because each of you has to figure out what is it that has this magic combination of something that I really love to do and actually also something I'm pretty good at doing, which is not always the same thing. I loved being a journalist, but I found I was really, really terrible at it. Because I was, when I went home, I was not curious about what was going on. And terrible noises outside my room. Go away, I want to read a book. No, if I was a journalist, I would go find out what that was. So I tried being a journalist and discovered that wasn't it. I tried other jobs. That it was going to be a kid, somebody to work with the poor. So I volunteered to work with the poor, which is great stuff. I learned a lot from it. But the poor, 10-year-old kid I was supposedly tutoring was bored to tears by me. I wasn't very good at that. Other people are. Find out what you're good at. Find out where am I happy and how can I make that a central part of my life.
So I'm imagining that as a young guy, school, high school, college, university, there were many doors open to you. Doors of study, of money, of relationship. And you're a Jesuit brother.
It's kind of odd because I was phenomenally privileged. And I don't mean economically. I mean, I had parents who loved me. I had a brother and sister who were great examples to me. I was an American white male in the 20th century. I was given all of this stuff that I did nothing to earn. And I had all of these opportunities. I had good health. I had, reasonable intelligence. I had financial security. I could do anything in the world I wanted to do. And it took me a long time to figure out, what actually do I want to do? because it's not an easy question to answer. And the answers that you get from television or, you know, your friends, well, television is garbage. Everybody knows that. Nothing on television is true. I've been on television, I know. And the answer that works for your friend isn't going to necessarily work for you. The answers that work for your parents won't necessarily work for you. And, you know, the next 20 years of your life is going to be stumbling around trying to figure this out, and you're going to get discouraged. But that's okay. Because when you find the place where you belong, you'll discover that all of the other things that you stumbled through on the way there are not wasted. It's all part and parcel of what makes that final place really a delightful place to be. I was nearly 40 years old before I finally decided to be a Jesuit brother. And before then, I had 2 years living in Africa. I had 4 years teaching at a small college that I loved. I had 5 years as a postdoctoral fellow in the biggest scientific institutions in the world. And I was willing to walk away from all of that to try to do the work that I finally realized God was calling me to do. And then, as a result, suddenly, as a Jesuit, I got to use, oh, the stuff I learned in science. Oh, the stuff I learned in Africa.
So
oh, the stuff I learned.
What you're doing today verifies those choices you made back then.
And, well, it not so much verifies them as it rescued them.
Yes.
Because at the time, they felt like really stupid choices. What was I thinking? And yet, I couldn't have the fun I'm having today if I hadn't made those so-called mistakes.
Well, I love the way you use words like fun and joy. For goodness sake, we're talking about science. I was never good as a science student at school. Now we're using words like life and fun.
And love.
Words like love. Like, tell that story you told at lunch about
Oh, yeah.
That was great.
This was something that hit me about 5 years ago, but it goes back to my memory when I was a little kid. I remember being a little kid, and it was a rainy Sunday afternoon. You couldn't go out to play. You know, total waste of a Sunday. You can't go outdoors. And so it was a rainy Sunday afternoon, and my mom called me over and had a deck of cards, and she dealt out the cards, and we're playing Rummy or some such little kid game. I'm maybe 10 years old. And when you're 10, most of the time you're 10 and you're pretty stupid. But every now and then you have this flash of maturity that you have, and like an adult understanding of the universe. And I had one of those flashes that said, wait a minute, Mom's a grown-up, I'm a kid. Why is she wasting her time playing cards with me? She could win any time she wanted to. What's she doing here? She's showing me, by spending time with me, she's showing me that she loves me. You know, if she had just said, Guy, I love you, I'm going to go, Mom, you know, give me a break. Because, you know, 10-year-old boys are like that. But rather than saying it, she showed it. And the insight hit me one day when I was in my lab making these measurements and plotting up data points. I don't know what they told you in school about science, where the scientific method, a scientist sees a problem, creates a hypothesis, devises an experiment to test the hypothesis. I never met a scientist who did any of those things. A scientist gets a new hammer, bashes things until they break, and then tries to figure out what the heck was going on and how can I write this up in time for the next grant proposal. So I was just, you know, I had a new hammer, I had a new tool, I was collecting a lot of data and trying to figure out, does this mean anything? And so you plot it, one variable against another, and suddenly, pow, there was a linear fit where I didn't expect it. And one, you know, the magnetic susceptibility is correlated with the grain density. Now, there are 5 people in the world who know what I'm talking about, and only 3 of them care. But I thought this was really cool. And it suddenly hit me, this was God playing cards with me. Okay, he's God, I'm not. But by setting up this game that I can play, where he knows how much I'm enjoying it, and he's enjoying me enjoying this discovery I've made, and he's going to say, that's really cool, wait till you see the next one I've set up for you. that moment of joy, very akin to the moment of joy you have in one of these moments of prayer when you go, my gosh, he's actually listening. That was God as parent having fun with a kid and expressing, it's a way that, it's a place where God and me can get together and have fun. One of the things that I remember a mathematician, I think it was Norbert Wiener, once wrote this. He says, you never understand mathematics, you just get used to it. And it's true of physics. You never understand physics, you just get used to it. That's why you have to spend so much time doing problems until you get used to it. You never understand your friends, you just get used to them. And you enjoy getting used to them. But if you think your friend is a problem to be solved, it's not a real friendship. You never understand God. You get used to God. And playing with God in the lab is a place where I have a chance to get used to him, to get to see his personality, to get to see his sense of humor. Who would have thought that these two variables were related to each other? Ha! Makes you want to laugh.
And I think that's part of what's surprising. Like, we're from a variety of schools. I think there's a dozen different schools here, and tertiary students represented. Many of us have a belief in God and others not. But for you, it's science and God are inseparable. It's as if you're speaking not so much about outer space, which is what we might have expected you to speak, you're speaking about inner space.
But it's in the outer space that I discover the inner space.
Wow. Say more about that.
It's when I'm, you know, why did I travel umpty thousand miles to come to New Zealand? And it was, yeah, they offered me a chance to give these talks and all of that. The real reason I came here is so that I had a night last night, two nights ago, in Lake Tekapo, looking at the stars in the southern hemisphere
that
I can't see from anywhere else. And it's just so beautiful. And the stars themselves are beautiful. Knowing what the stars are that I'm looking at is even more beautiful. Understanding the physics behind why there is a cluster of stars so big that it fills my binoculars, Omega Centauri, that I can't see from anywhere else except this far south. That joy is what drew me to come here. That joy, that sense of fun, is why I keep going back to the science and keep doing the tedious work of collecting the data. I dropped 5 meteorites, so I got 5 more data points. I need 100 data points before I can start plotting things up. So that's what another, it's 20 days with, that's 4 weeks, that's a month of dropping rocks into liquid nitrogen. And actually, you want to do it 5 times each, so that's like 5 months. Because at the end of the day, I'll have this pile of data that I can start playing with and wondering, how does that work? And why are they related? Why aren't they related when they ought to be? What's going on? It's fun to play with the liquid nitrogen. It's fun to have the data and play with the data. It's fun because God wants us to be happy. God is expressed in joy. And if anyone says they don't believe in God, but they believe in joy, all I can say is, you haven't recognized what I've recognized. And, you know, I'm not saying anything, I hope, particularly profound. But that which makes me happy to be alive is where I find God.
I was a little kid when I was first introduced to the sky. I don't ever remember looking up before age 7 when I was out with my grandfather on the farm just south of Waimate. And he showed me the Southern Cross, and I remember being amazed that he knew the names of these stars. And then he tried to show me other pictures in the sky, the constellations. I remember going to the Northern Hemisphere for the first time and it just wasn't there. Like, our sky here in New Zealand is very different.
It is.
Tell us about the difference.
There are some people who want to claim that the world is flat, and how do you know it's not flat? I know the stars in the north. I've known them since I was about 5. Mm-hmm. My dad taught me as well. And there is this marvelous constellation called Leo the Lion, which has got a little backwards question mark, that's the lion's mane, and some stars that make the snout, and then a triangle of stars, it's like the hindquarters of the lion. And it's right below the Big Dipper, and everybody in the Northern Hemisphere knows the Big Dipper. So you see the Big Dipper, you see Leo the Lion. And last night, or 2 nights ago, in Tekapo, I saw Leo the Lion, but he's on his back. He's upside down. Well, he's not upside down, I'm upside down. And to have the experience of traveling that you can see the world right side up and upside down and be able to say, wait a minute, who's right side up and who's upside down? Depends where you started from. That is also, that's a joke. What's a joke? It's seeing something you've seen over and over again the same way, but from a new point of view, and having a new insight. And science is the best book of jokes.
I watched Q&A last night. Some of you may have seen it as well, with Jack Tame interviewing you, and about the Tekapo trip, but that's where you were interviewed. But at the end, after you'd finished, like there were four or five segments on the show, politics and all kinds of things, they saved you right to the end, so we all had to stay up till 11 o'clock to see you. But then after you finished, he said, well, on the program tonight, we've had all kinds of things, and I'm going to quote this. He said, and we even deal with the defining existential question for our species. Talking about the interview with you, saying, is there life on other planets? So,
is that the ultimate existential, whatever that was,
question?
I don't know. That's the important thing to be able to say about any scientific question. I don't know. If I did know, then it would be like the preacher. You know, if I knew I could walk on water, then there'd be, you know, no point in trying it. I don't know if there's life elsewhere. But I've seen babies, and a little baby discovers that there's another little baby, and they begin to interact. Or a puppy discovers that there's another puppy, and they begin to interact. Or a six-year-old going off to school, meeting other six-year-olds, and discovering that the universe is bigger than just themselves. Or you're on an airplane and you discover that the fellow sitting next to you, you know, is a fan of the same sports team, or maybe even plays for that sports team. We get joy by discovering other people, and it makes us grow, and we hope it makes them grow. I would hope that we infants here on planet Earth we'll be able to see the infants on what other planet there is and learn from each other. And not that anything we thought was wrong, but everything we thought was incomplete. I hope that's the case. So, if you were to come to me, I'm the director of the observatory now, you know, Pope gives me €1.5 million a year to spend on astronomy. And you come to me and you say, I want some of that money because I want to study, is there extraterrestrial life? And I say, how are you going to do it? Well, here's my plan. I go, sounds good to me. Go for it. I don't know that it's there. It could be a total waste of money. Even if it turns out to be a false answer, it won't be a waste of money because we will have learned something. But I have enough faith that the question is worth asking and pursuing that I'm willing to devote resources to it. Because science is based on faith. I think this is a worthwhile project. I think that your approach might be fruitful. I think that we could learn something from it. I could be wrong. It could be a total waste of time and effort. But I don't know that ahead of time. And I have to have faith that it's there. I mean, if you came to me and said you wanted to go hunt UFOs and flying saucers, and I'd say, I don't think so. I don't believe in flying saucers. I could be wrong about that, too. I don't have faith in flying saucers, but I do have faith in the bigger question that there could be life elsewhere.
So much so that you've named a recent book, Would You Baptize an Extraterrestrial?
And other crazy questions that people keep asking us, yes. But also, I'm on the science advisory board for the SETI Institute, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute. So, you know, I'm willing to put a little bit of my time into it.
Now, you've often spoken to young people, to high school students, college, university students. What's the most interesting question that you've been asked?
Interesting. Oh, I can tell you the most common one.
What's the most common one?
The most common is, do you believe in extraterrestrials? Sorry, you just asked me.
Actually, you need to answer that question. The one, would you baptize
would
an
you
extraterrestrial?
Baptize?
The answer?
The answer is only if she asks. You know, that's the way baptism works.
So what's the most common question that you've been
asked? But the most interesting one,
Most interesting.
I gave a talk about the moons of Jupiter and the geology of the moons of Jupiter, which at one time was my research. And I gave it at a college in South Carolina, the Bible Belt of America, College of Charleston, South Carolina. And a kid came up afterwards and he says, I love this stuff. And he says, I want to be a geologist. I want to study geology. He says, so his question is, what do I tell my mom? What? He comes from a culture where they think if you believe in geology, then you've rejected the Bible. He comes from a culture where his mom is not going to be proud of him if he becomes a geologist. She's going to be embarrassed that he's become one of those godless scientists like me. And I didn't have an answer. I certainly didn't have a soundbite answer. Wow. And we talked about it for a while, and finally, you realized that the only way, if you're going to be a geologist, the only way you can convince your mom that you're not godless is to not be godless, is to be a good person, living a good life. And that means you can't answer it with a soundbite. You've got to actually live a good life, which is a whole lifetime's worth of effort. Mm-hmm. It seems unfair.
Yeah, right.
But
now I just need to check our time. I can't see. How are we going here? We're okay. For another, how many minutes? Another 10 minutes we have.
Okay. Great.
Well, then I want to ask a follow-up to that. I want to ask, what's a question that you've been asked that you've never asked yourself and that you suddenly thought, wow, that's unique, that's real, that's good?
I mean, that particular question was one that I never had to deal with. I came from a family where they supported me going to school, they supported me getting a doctorate, they supported me doing useless things like science. Mm-hmm. And it made me realize that that's not true of everybody. I have no idea what happened to that kid, but that event had a tremendous, tremendous effect on me.
Well, probably a little like...
Oh, I'll give you a scientific question. And this is an old buddy of mine. I was describing the work we were doing measuring the density of the meteorites. Now, what are meteorites? We talked about this. These are lumps of rock that come from the asteroid belt. They're chipped off asteroids. And we've seen pictures of asteroids. They're piles of rock. And we have an idea of how these are 4.5 billion years old as the solar system. They're, in some cases, older than the planets. And we have an idea of how planets are formed because we can see this happening elsewhere where stars are being formed, that you have a cloud of gas and dust which is collapsing, but it's also spinning. So it collapses from the top and the bottom and it makes a disk. And you've got this disk of gas and dust, and the dust coagulates and forms planets. Everybody following me? You got a picture of that? And so my friend says to me, Guy, why are there meteorites? You go, huh? What do you mean? Get the cloud of gas and dust. No, I know all that, he says. How come we have rocks and we don't just have big dust bunnies? And I go, well, it's because it's... And that's kind of been the motivation of a lot of my research for the last 20 years, is to come up with a reasonable answer, and I don't have one yet.
Does money limit what you are able to do in terms of your dreams or your projects?
It does and it doesn't. If someone donated $10 million to the observatory, I've got a place where I'd spend it. I would love to invest in a giant telescope that's being built in South America right now, the giant Magellan telescope. And I'd love the Vatican to have a slice of that telescope time. We don't have $10 million, so I can't do that. And yet, think of the research I did. I don't have the $1 million machine, but I've got a friend who's got a $1 million machine. And not having the $1 million machine made me come up with a way of measuring meteorites. Well, of course, the coffee thermos cost $20, and the plastic canister cost about $1. And the scale, well, that was about $500, and the computer attached to it is about $500. So for $1,021, I've got a way of measuring meteorite heat capacity that in some ways is better than the $1 million machine.
So is that project kind of complete now?
No. I'm the director. Now, they made me the director 4 years ago. Pope Francis, I'll never forgive him for that. You know, so I've got to be the director now. It's actually a lot of fun because I get to help out all the other guys doing their work. But there was a young Jesuit who had an interest in meteorites who has taken over the meteorite lab, and he's doing these measurements. The one problem with his work in the meteorite lab is he's better at it than I was, the rat. But as long as he puts me on the scientific papers, then I'm happy.
Well, if the younger are not better at these things, then the world's going backwards.
So. Well, this is true. And I know my grandparents always told me the world was going backwards, so now that I'm their age, I get to say the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Tell us about, true. You mentioned Pope Francis, and like he's doing a lot of things in a very different way, and that kind of excites us. I think it worries some people, but generally it's exciting. Tell me about how your experience of him, because you've met him a few times.
I have. You know, at this point, when we have an audience, when we bring famous scientists in and he, you know, reads a nice statement to them, he walks in the room and he comes over and he greets me personally because he knows who I am. And that's kind of scary. It's nice, but it's scary. There are a lot of things I could say about him, but the thing that impresses me the most is how powerful he is by being humble. About 6 months ago, there was somebody in the church who attacked him bitterly and unfairly. And if I were him, I would be tempted to, you know, blast back with all, you know, guns blazing. That's not the way it works, and that's not what's going on. And instead he said, well, you know, you're members of the press, check out what he had to say. See if it's true. Part of that comes from the fact that, you know, he's Pope. He's not running for re-election. He's not going to lose his job over people not liking him. But he's also not worried about whether people like him or not. He's not worried about what other people think. He's worried about how he stands with God.
So he's free.
And that makes him incredibly free.
Yeah.
One of the most wonderful insights into God's omnipotence is to recognize if somebody is really strong, somebody is really powerful, they don't have to show it off. They don't have to test it. If I am concerned about the fact that I want to prove to you that I'm smarter than you are, it's because I doubt it. I'm afraid maybe I'm not smarter than you are. Whereas if I don't care, it's because I know that smart isn't a linear scale and there's no such thing as smarter than you are. God became a part of God's physical universe that God created, which is an astonishing thing to do. And there are many cultures and many stories of many religions where the gods come down to earth. And usually they're not fooling around. They come with a cloud of light and thunder, and they make sure that everybody knows they're there for business. Except when our God came to this creation, he came as a baby of a poor couple in the middle of nowhere, Palestine. Because when you're omnipotent, you don't have to be afraid of being powerless.
As you speak about this, this is the fact that's changed your life. It's not scientific facts and astronomy. Yeah. It's this fact of God as a baby coming into human creation.
And, you know, it speaks to my own insecurities, or I'm, you know, sort of revealing myself here, that, yeah, I was the kid who was always worried because I was never the smartest kid in my class. I was always the second smartest, and that rankled. And I was always worried about what people were going to think of me. And the more you act out of worrying about what somebody's going to think, the more you make a fool of yourself, and they think even less of you. And it took giving up science. You know, when I joined the Peace Corps, I thought I was giving up science, and they asked me to be a scientist. And when I joined the Jesuits, I thought they were asking me to give up research science, and in fact, I'm able to do research science like I would never have believed I could have done. But it was by letting go of it that I allowed it to happen. And that's a lifetime of lessons to learn to let go of the things you're afraid of. And I'm reassured in this. This is the Easter season, and we have all these stories of Jesus coming back from the dead. I'm curious, you know, when you got the resurrected Lord on the seashore, Peter's coming in, and he doesn't call everybody and says, look, I've been back from the dead, let me tell you what it's all about. He doesn't do that. He doesn't give them lectures in theology. He says, hey, let's have some fish for breakfast. Not why I'd want fish for breakfast, but, you know. And that's more important than theological. The theology comes later. The theology is wonderful. I love the theology. But breakfast comes first.
I like that.
And, yeah. And that sense that God is willing to just be. But the thing that's reassuring to me is that every time he does appear, the first thing he says is, don't be afraid. Which is to say, they're really afraid. And it's okay for me to be afraid. Because I've got a God whose first thing is to say to me, don't be afraid.
You see, we live in an environment here in Christchurch, to be very specific. Like, we've had a rough dozen years.
Yeah.
Like, we've had earthquakes and then
the terrorist
attack on the 15th of March. Like, and I'm wondering, what does, can I put it this way, what does astronomy have to teach us in this situation we find ourselves here in Christchurch?
I go back to the September 11, 2001 attacks in America and how that shook people. And at the end of the day, going out and looking at the stars reminded me that as horrible as that was, it was minuscule in the grand scheme. And that's not to say that it was tiny. It's to say that the rest of the universe is even bigger. And this is not original with me. When Job, in the book of Job, is despairing, and God speaks to him out of the whirlwind, chapter 38, what God says is, you're worried about, you know, all these things happening to you. Come with me and let me show you the dwelling of light. Let me show you where the foundations of the earth have been built. Let me show you this universe that makes every bit of evil, which is definitely evil, pale in comparison to the goodness that is to be found and that can never be taken away.
I find that very, very hopeful. I find that. I'm aware that we're right on time and we don't want to finish on time. But there is one more question I want to ask you. We are a small country. You've reminded us we're a beautiful country, and we are very proud of it. And we're aware of how easy it is to lose the beauty we have with a lack of care of the environment. I know Pope Francis has spoken on this. But I'm wondering what you, from your projects, your research, your experiments, from your faith, what would you say to us? What does astronomy teach us about our environment here on Earth?
I'll give you a quote from Pope Benedict, who in many ways foreshadowed all the good things that Pope Francis has done. I'm a big Benedict fan as well as a big Francis fan. And we just had Easter Sunday. I don't know how many of you actually went to the incredibly, infinitely long Easter Sunday night celebrations. But it starts with a dark church and a candle is lit, and it's a sort of contrast of light and dark. And Pope Benedict, at the homily he gave on Easter Sunday, about 2012, I guess, reminded us that we can blind ourselves to God's lights by our own human lights, so that you go into a city now and you can't see the Milky Way anymore. You can't see the stars because we have filled the city with our own useless light.
This is pollution.
Light pollution. And he says that's what sinfulness is. It's creating our own noise to drown out God's voice, small, still voice. to create our own light, to blind ourselves to the beautiful light that God is trying to show us. That's what human sinfulness is.
Guy, I'm going to give you the last word in about a minute, all right? So think of what your last word to this group is. But I want to thank you for being here in Christchurch, and I want to thank you all for being here. I suppose that for me, this day already, the lunchtime and now, has been a bit of a beginning, because there are many things that you've said, Guy, that have certainly informed my head, but I'd say have moved my heart too. And there are many ways that we can follow up. I know there hasn't been an opportunity to take individual questions here, but I think most of what we might have asked has been, Guy has spoken about, but also there's a world of resources, like you've got websites and things, and dozens
I've got the world's easiest name to Google, so, you know, it's, there's no hiding.
Guy Consumalno, yes. Right. So just, but YouTube clips as well, you're speaking in a number of YouTube clips, so there are many
ways. There's also YouTube clips that show that I believe that Jesus Christ was actually an alien, so don't believe everything on YouTube. I did not say that, but somebody said that I said that.
So may this event this afternoon be a beginning for all of us to deepen, certainly to enjoy and to savor the things that have given us good information. But so much of what you have said, even just in the last hour, has moved me. And I can feel that, and it's something real is happening there for me. So I said I'd give you the last word. Here it is.
And the word will be patience. Don't expect to have the answers right now. Don't worry if you don't have the answers right now. Be patient and be aware, because the truth comes slowly and it takes a long time to listen to it. Whether, you know, when I was 18, I had no idea what I was going to do for my life. And if you had asked me, it would be totally different from where I was. But that's okay, because I only got to where I am by following where I was then, in what turned out to be a really interesting, if kind of convoluted, path. And I hope all of you have interesting convoluted paths. You're all writing the science fiction novel that is your life. And why do I say it's a science fiction novel? Because it's set in the future. Have patience. Let it unfold. And have patience with each other.